You're listening to 93.3 WMMR online. My name's Marcus, and in the studio with me is the older sister of an incredible frontman who sadly left us in 1997. She wrote a beautiful book about him that answers many questions about who he was, called Michael, My Brother, the Lost Boy of NXS. She is Tina Hutchins, and she is here to talk Michael, the book, and a little bit more. Tina, welcome, and thank you so much for coming into the studio to chat Michael, NXS, and more today.
Well, thank you, Marcus. I'm happy to be here, and it's nice to hear that.
You wrote the first book, Just a Man, The Real Michael Hutchins, in 2000. What was missing from the story that compelled you to write this book 17 years later?
Well, I have to say that when I wrote that book, and I started it probably 2 weeks after Michael died, because I've always written to get through anything, any problems I have. And I felt that I wrote it too fast. I didn't really go as deep as I wanted to. And I just felt there was so much more to tell. And then I found out more about his head injury. And then more things started to make sense to me. And I wanted to discuss that.
So you found out about the head injury after you had written the book in 2000. Is that also when you got to read his journals and some of those personal mementos of his?
Exactly. Yes. And I knew he'd hit his head. I knew he'd gone down on the path, but I didn't know how bad it was.
From what you wrote in the book, it sounded like it was quite a drastic change.
It was. It was tremendous. He just, first of all, he sort of disappeared for 3 weeks, and he was actually with Helena Christensen. She was caring for him. And at the time, he had asked her not to tell anyone. He sort of felt he was not himself, there was something wrong, and he was a bit afraid. He didn't want anyone to know. So she didn't tell the family. But I just felt that I was reading a little bit about traumatic brain injuries, and I thought, that just sounds like Michael. He lost his senses of taste and smell right away, never returned.
The way you described it, being the person that he was, those were two very important to him, and especially with the fact that he loved to cook.
He did, yes. And even as a lyricist, as a poet, those senses are very close to you because he's describing those in a lot of his lyrics, and I think that was devastating for him.
Yeah, one of the things that came out of the book that seemed very interesting was that he used his words, and if you read between the lines, he revealed a little bit about himself, but you had to know him in a way to how he was revealing himself.
That's so accurate. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, he's a fascinating individual. Some of the things that blew me away in the book were the fact that he always carried a book with him in his hand and one in his suitcase, and he loved to read. Did that continue even through the party years when he was still whooping it up and going out after the shows and doing the rock and roll thing? Did he still read a lot during
Absolutely.
That time?
Absolutely, he did. He always had a book around. In those days, we were faxing. He'd write something to me like, I've just started reading this book. You should pick it up. It's really good. And he always had books. When the guys were touring on a bus, he'd be the one in the back with a book. He'd have his nose in a book. So
you said he kept a journal, too. Did he journal a lot as a child?
Not so much as a child. Maybe in his teen years, he was writing a lot. He was sort of writing, I called it his poetry. And you never knew, like, if I left an envelope or something around the house, and I'd come back later and there would be words scribbled on it, because something would come to him and he didn't want to lose what he had in his head, you know? Actually, I was telling somebody how he was staying with me, and I got up from the breakfast table. I was going to take a shower. When I came back, he said, I'm going to take a shower too. And I saw some of my bills I had ready to go to downstairs, and he took them. And Michael came out about an hour later and said, where'd you put the stuff on the table? Gone.
You spent some time living in Hong Kong, and you lived in Hong Kong kind of during a crazy time. Vietnam was going on, the Korean War was ending, you also had the Chinese Revolution of 67, and you wrote a little bit about being stuck where you had a curfew and military was out, and you heard bombs and gunfire. What was that like, and did that have an impact on you as a teenager, and how did it impact a 7-year-old Michael?
I think it had an effect on all of us. I mean, we were from Australia, where you don't see anything going on, you know? And it was quite amazing. I mean, the whole time in Hong Kong was an education, just wonderful. But this was a very scary time because, yes, you had the military was walking the streets. By 7 o'clock, you had to be in somewhere. As a teenager, I just enjoyed it because I could go somewhere and we would party. I couldn't leave till 7 in the morning. What a shame, you know. I had a very good excuse. I think for Michael, you know, he was about 7 at the time, and it impacted him a lot because he saw things that, you know, all the people marching down the street and having to stay in, people knocking on the door to please let me in because it was after curfew. Yeah, I think that did a lot for him, you know, just to see this.
Those are things I don't think children should have to see.
No, but, you know, they do. And it's amazing. They deal with it in a whole different way.
You also described your life sort of growing up as gypsy-like in a lot of ways. Mm. Because you had two younger brothers when you were about 12, and due to your family situation, you ended up becoming a caretaker and missing out on a lot of those aspects of childhood, I guess, quote-unquote, normal teen childhood things. How did that impact you as a person, and was that hard for you? Did you have any resentment or bitterness towards either your brothers or your mother or your father growing up?
You know, not the boys. I loved the boys. And I recognized intuitively that they needed me. They needed a mother. And my mother was very busy. She was a very popular model and makeup artist. So she just wasn't there. She was helping the family get by. For me, I think I resented my parents only because, you know, I was, okay, so I'm old enough to take care of this little baby and this toddler for a weekend. But if I wanted to go out, it was, you have to be home by 10, or no, you can't go out two nights running, that kind of, you know. Didn't make sense to me.
This also shaped you and who you were, but it also seems that because of that, you ended up having a really nice relationship with both your brothers over the years, which at that age difference, it's really hard to have a close relationship with brothers or sisters when there's 10, 12, 14 years between them. That's almost a generation.
Exactly. This is true. But what happened was they got older, we became closer, because then we could speak on the same level. And I thought it was natural to me because that's all I knew, you know, and we were always traveling. So I always had, you know, that was my grounding.
As somebody who traveled, would you recommend that families have those experiences versus things?
Well, I think travel is very important, but it really should start later in life. You know, for my children, I sent them, when both of them were 16, I sent them around on a train trip through Europe. That was good for them. But I think earlier, it's very difficult when you're traveling around, you're living in different places. You really, where are your friends? I was always in a different uniform to everybody else, and it's hard.
Do you have any friends from your childhood years that you still remain in contact with from those younger years?
I have one friend that I could keep in contact with, you know, in Australia.
At the end of the book, you shared a story of, I think, a boy named Tim Stewart.
Mm.
Without going into too much detail, if you want to get a feel for who Michael was as a person, I think that might be one of the best examples you could give, because it really showed a lot about him and his courage as a person.
That's a lovely way of putting it, Marcus. I think it's true. As a matter of fact, I just spent 3 weeks with Tim and his wife.
Oh, wow.
It was wonderful.
Without giving too much away, I recommend, especially if you're an NXS fan, read the book. It seems to be a lot happier, but once the accident comes at the second half of the book, it starts to turn a little darker.
Mm.
And I don't know if that was intentional, as you wrote it intentionally, or if that's how it ended up just coming out.
It just came out, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I read it back, I realized, it did get dark.
Mm-hmm.
He was in trouble. But when you have somebody so close and they're in trouble, they're on the other side of the world, when you get together, you have those just a couple of days that you just want to be happy. And, you know, he would say, I'd say something's troubling you. I know you're having trouble. And he'd say, I don't want to talk about that. Let's go have something good to eat. Or
some of the other stories that were really interesting is that when he would talk to regular people, he would show a genuine interest in getting to know them. The Lost Boy is a great way to describe him because he totally was not the type of person you would expect in the nastiness of showbiz or anything like that. He's totally the opposite, very much like Kurt Cobain, very much like Scott Weiland, very much like Chris Cornell. He was very similar to all of them in that way, and he cared about the people a lot, and it came across. They've been one of my favorite bands since I first saw The One Thing on TV and was blown away by it. There was something unique and individual about them, and they never compromised their sound. They did it their way always.
True.
In a world of formulaic music and a lot of record label power, they took on the world their way and they did it their way. And I think they used their Australian-ness to their advantage in that way. Yeah. And what they did was brilliant. I know that you wrote about a few off shows there, but I would be willing to bet money on some of those off shows. Most of the audience couldn't tell that they were off.
I'm sure they couldn't. So, yeah. No, they were one of the greatest live bands around.
They really were. The musicianship of the whole band is amazing. One of the things that was really, I think, sad at the end of the book is that when he left, they were all on not so good terms. Mm. And that has to be torture for every one of them in some aspects.
I think so. I think they, you know, I haven't seen very much of them at all. I went to one show, actually, some time ago, before they just stopped playing altogether, and they were almost embarrassed. They just felt like they came out to greet me, but it was like they didn't really want to talk to me. And Andrew, who was his writing partner, held me close for so long, you know, when you start to pull away, but they're still holding. And I said, "Are you okay?" He said, "This is just the closest I've been to Michael in so long." And he was weeping.
Hearing the breakdown of their relationship was really sad as well. Did the Max Q situation impact their songwriting after that, as far as trust and as far as chemistry goes?
I think it did, actually, because Michael felt more confident in speaking up. You know, there were times when he would speak up in the years before that, and I really don't believe the guys took him seriously. He felt they didn't, anyway.
But they had to take him seriously. He and Andrew wrote all their songs and wrote brilliant songs.
That's true. And they were all making money from that.
A lot of money.
A lot, and still do.
And I'm glad that they do. I'm glad that they're all still making money from that. They deserve it. That's their creative work.
Absolutely. But I think that Max Q showed them that, you know, Michael could do something on his own, which scared them a little. I think they were just a bit afraid.
Reading about some of the Bad Blood was shocking because, again, the impression that they were all as close as they were was sort of, that illusion was sort of shattered in the book, but not in a bad way. It's realistic, I guess. It was sad to see because their albums were so good, every one of them. And even the later albums with Taste It and Not Enough Time and Beautiful Girl and...
But I think, you know, people grow musically and sometimes they just don't grow the same way. You know, he wanted to try other things. He didn't want to keep the same sound. Mm-hmm. He thought they needed to branch out a bit more, and they were very comfortable. The rest of the band was very comfortable on keeping that 80s sound.
And he was a move forward guy.
Yeah, he was very creative and he wanted to try other things.
I'm surprised. I mean, that band had insane amounts of talent. The horns, the guitar. They were a completely talented, great band. And one of the areas that's not really discussed is the Australian rock and roll family trees. And you go over it a little bit in the book. But what surprised me is on his last day, one of the few people he called was Nick Cave. But that's the only time you mention him in the book. And Nick Cave from The Birthday Party On is one of my guys, too. His music and his persona is amazing.
Well, his creativity.
He's off the charts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On anything, any level. And yes, he'd been a good friend of Michael's. Because Michael spent a lot of time in London. And there wasn't anything else I wanted to say about that. I just needed to.
But I was surprised that he was the only one. That was the only time you had mentioned him, because you had mentioned Dave Faulkner before the Hoodoo Gurus. I can't remember the name of the band, the Vipers maybe, or the something. It was interesting that the family tree, the Models, Cold Fever. I still remember that song as a kid. Australian Crawl. When I was in 85, I went to American University. One of the gals that we hung out with was from Australia. So she turned me on to Australian Crawl and some of the other bands from Australia, Midnight Oil. And then I ended up seeing seeing Midnight Oil and the Hoodoo Gurus in D.C. in 85 at the 930 Club. So
you know more about Australian music than I do.
Oh, come on. You were part of it. But yeah, like these bands were just, the scene was amazing. But you wrote about some of these bands, but like Cold Chisel, I did not know about. So now I'm curious to check out their sound. From what I've read, they're an influence on a lot of the later Australian sounding bands, a major influence and a major player.
Absolutely. And Cold Chisel is it's just an institution. I mean, those guys are crazy, but so talented. And I was glad I was able to get a lot in there about Australian bands, because I don't think people over here know enough about the history of rock and roll in Australia.
And it's definitely a history that needs to be touched on. There's some big bands that people don't realize. Like you mentioned, Duncan McGuire of Focus. Mm-hmm. Hocus Pocus. Mm-hmm. Focus. Yeah. And that's the one that people know, but they don't know as much. But I guess I would describe him as, he had sort of a Jim Morrison type of charisma with a Marvin Gaye and Sam Cooke kind of a wooing about him.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, he said to me, you know, people just mention all these other people all the time. He said, yeah, they're another generation for me. I wasn't, you know, he wasn't privy to the moves and everything these people made, you know. Yeah. But he didn't realize the special thing that he had. He didn't understand that it was just natural to him, the way he would find him outside talking to the janitor because the janitor had an interesting story or something, mm-hmm. and the party's in here, you know. He just was interested in people and life.
Was it hard for him to be around that fast life, the social scene, because of that? Do you think that maybe because he was creatively different than a lot of that scene, that party scene, that he mm-hmm. maybe partied a little harder to deal with it and to cope with it and to cope with the business end of it? Because the business end of the music industry is nasty.
And I didn't know that until after Michael died, actually. But no, I think that he at first partied a bit because just to get out on the stage, because he was actually, he could be quite shy at times. So I think that wasn't easy for him to step out. He would sing, but he was used to singing in the garage, you know, just with the guys, and he'd put his head down. But something happened when he stepped out on that stage. And I mean, at first, he didn't come full out like that. He devised this thing where he would wear a suit, and he'd take the jacket off, then he'd take something else off. And then, and he was like, he was opening himself, unpeeling and opening himself to the audience.
Was it hard for him to open to the audience like that? Or because you wrote in the book a couple of times that he lived for those 2 hours on stage. That was his absolute favorite part.
He got to do that, yes. I'm talking about the beginning, but when he started to feel comfortable, he was comfortable and enjoyed it. He really did.
Wow.
Yeah.
On page 92, you said that Michael said that he hated time. Why did Michael hate time?
He was talking about waiting between the when he stepped off stage before to when he's getting back on.
So that time between that stage appearances he hated. Mm. Didn't like that at all. This band seemed to always take their significant others with them on tour with them if they were dating and didn't have kids. Mm. And they would always, on the extra days, jump off and tour. Mm. That is so Australian, because when I backpacked through Europe in 99, everybody I met was Australian. Not everybody, but I met so many Australians on the way. And it was amazing, because that type of travel is almost like a rite of passage for Australians.
Well, that's right. And before they start university or anything else, they go off for a year.
It's an absolutely brilliant way to live. You get a whole new view of the world you live in. Because a lot of times bands hole up in their hotels because they're tired of dealing with people and things like that. But these guys always just went out and explored no matter where they were. Even if they'd been there 10 times, they'd still went out and explored new stuff.
Well, he often complained about that aspect because he was stuck at the hotel giving interviews, of course. Everybody wanted to speak to him. But then it turned around where the guys were, they were getting a bit jealous that they weren't asked for.
Yeah.
And that's a normal thing in a band, I think.
You talk a lot about the women in Michael's life, and throughout the time you mentioned that he would probably never settle down, which you had expected, but he eventually had a child.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in touch with Tiger Lily at all now?
Not at all.
So sorry.
That's just the greatest sadness of my life, to have basically brought up her father. Bob Geldof fought me for that, and there was no way I could win in London on that.
No way. He was a hero in London.
Yes, and the thing was, well, I would be bringing her back over here, be staying in London. I have my own children. No, that's a great sadness. I hope one day she'll want to come see me.
I hope so, too. That part of the story really broke my heart, and it seems like Paula played everybody against everybody and did a phenomenal job at doing such.
Yes, well, it's true, but Paula was not well. I mean, Paula definitely was borderline personality. There's no doubt about it. And I remember when I first met Bob Geldof, he took me out to lunch and he said, you know, Paula's not well. I had no idea what he was talking about. He said, I've had her to many psychiatrists and there's something strange, you know. But he wouldn't really tell me. And so when I would stand there with her and on one side she'd tell somebody something I could hear, over here she'd tell the same story, but with a different ending, a completely different turnaround, and I could not understand it. She just kept telling stories and had to be in the limelight. It was very sad, the whole ending.
How were you able to piece together his last few days? Because that seemed like that was a daunting task, both emotionally and from a research standpoint.
Yes. Well, as I say, he'd been in Los Angeles with Danny Saber. They had been recording a little bit, and Michael called me on the Sunday night. He was leaving to go back to Australia, and we just had this conversation. He said, I don't want to go. I said, I don't think you should. You don't owe anybody anything. You've given 20 years. If you can't face those last six concerts, they can be put off. You're in excess.
Look what the Rolling Stones do.
Exactly.
And they were at the top of their game at that time.
Yeah. And he said, no, I'll be letting the guys down. They'll be upset with me, you know. They'll think I'm pulling that, you know, I'm better than anybody card. And he said, no, I've got to go. And he left that night. And what I found out was just from people he'd called. What I did was I just went back and spoke to the people he called. I had his sheet from the hotel to say what phone numbers. I spoke to Detective Duclos, who did the whole, and he was head of the investigation, and he gave me all the statements everybody had given and spoke very, he was outright with me. You know, he was very good. He would answer any question. Inspector Duclos, this particular case of Michael's just hit him so hard, he actually left the force, and he's been, ever since, he's been helping people in trouble, suicide.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it didn't make sense when we heard that story. Mm. Like, that was like, again, you know, us regular people, you hear about, you know, this, and then it happens, and everybody's like, what? Yeah. But then slowly all of the stories started coming out about Bob and Paula. And, like, even though I was in radio, I didn't really follow much of the gossip magazines, because to me, a lot of that was baloney. This aspect of it is crazy, and it's obvious from what you wrote in the book that he hated the paparazzi and being followed and chased, and I think that started with his relationship with Kylie.
It did, but he wasn't bothered so much then, because Australians, they sort of take things with them.
Yeah.
It's
a better sense of humor,
like,
than the British. Yeah.
Like the show. But, you know, and he'd talk to them. It was no big deal. But in London, he couldn't get away from it, because that was London.
Yeah.
You know, in the 80s, I mean, you think of Princess Diana.
Oh, yeah.
That was, yeah, what was going on. I don't know. You know, I think if he had not had the traumatic brain injury, he would have been able to get through that night.
Absolutely.
It's just, you know, you lose it all. He couldn't handle things anymore.
And the traumatic brain injury it's a big issue. One little bump of the head can cause some serious rewiring.
Absolutely.
Of your brain. And we're just learning about it. And we've seen it happening for decades with all these athletes and the head injuries and the alcoholism and the drug addiction that go in with it, because a lot of times it's to numb the pain. What
right.
pain? The pain that they can't describe and that they can't tell you about, but the pain that's always there.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And you said that after the head injury, did you notice a difference in Michael right away?
I think I saw him about 3 months after it had happened. He came over to L.A., and he wasn't, I noticed then, he was not as agreeable as he always. Always he was just, yeah, let's try that. Okay, he'd just go along with whatever. He just loved life. And I actually sent a letter down to his hotel. He was in L.A. with Helena. And I was telling him that I thought he was kind of being a bit up himself, because I'd seen him at a concert. He didn't come out right away to say hi to the family or anything. That was not Michael,
yeah.
You know. And I just didn't like what was happening. It didn't seem right because he'd never been like that. But I didn't have an answer for it. And he called me and said, come down to the hotel. We're going to have lunch and we're going to talk this out. And we did. I mean, we talked all afternoon. In the end, I said, yes, I guess don't worry about it. And he sent me off with this gorgeous coat that Helena had worn in some show 2 days before. And he said, it suits you, fits you, you know, happy birthday. I mean, so I didn't think about it anymore. But there was a definite, you know, he would fly off the handle. And that was just not Michael. So
I was surprised at his relationship with Helena. It seemed like out of all the women that he was with, she was the one that was the best match for him.
Yeah, I think she was perfect. Of course, they both loved traveling. They both traveled for their business. She was very easygoing. But after she was embarrassed by him being caught with Paula, that she just couldn't.
The family at the villa, the Christmas story at the villa in France, I'm surprised you didn't post one of those pictures from that day of the family all there, because it looked like it was, and it sounded like it was a really fun time. And it sounded like one of the things that Michael enjoyed the most was hosting family and taking care of family.
I think he was so happy to become the patriarch of the family. That's what he became. And it had to be because our parents were still, they'd still have the, you know, how parents, when they're divorced, they're not usually. And with his house, and it was all, you know, the 2 weeks was his party. So we were all getting along. It was wonderful. Actually, though, you can see some of the video from it in Richard Lowenstein's new movie, Mystify.
Ooh.
Mystify, Michael Hutchence.
Is that out?
We just saw it at Tribeca. It did very well. And it's coming out in Australia on July 4th. And it's making its way around the world.
The Suicide Blonde, I did not realize that that was the from the turn of the Jean Harlow Blonde. And that was pretty interesting that that song came and the title came from that. And there was also a movie, I can't remember. It was a documentary that was done a while back about Never Tear Us Apart or something like that. Story of NXS. And I think there was a scene where Andy and Michael were writing a song by the piano and it just like popped out. And it seemed like they had that type of chemistry. Was that a pretty accurate portrayal of their chemistry? Did they really write that well together?
They did at that time, because they were sent away to just do this and come back in a week. Let's see what you can come up with. That's what the producer told them to do. But normally what would happen is Andy would have all of this music. He'd give Michael tapes and tapes and tapes. And he'd say, you know, so this is what we're doing for the next album. And Michael would take them away and he'd have all those pieces of paper that I talked about.
Yeah, all the little note, the torn scraps.
Together and he'd figure, what is this, you know, and get the feel for it. And he'd put all that together and they'd just get together in the studio. Yeah.
And then he would use them and cut and paste. Cut and paste and sing.
Yeah.
Now, also on page 146, you said in the villa that there was a Frida Kahlo self-portrait. Is that an original Frida Kahlo self-portrait that was in the villa?
He and Helena had an apartment in Paris. It was in the Paris apartment. You know, I don't know. I just assume because he used to buy a lot of art. He spent a lot of money on art and special. He loved mirrors. And it's not a mirror for him just to stand there and look at. I have one of those mirrors. He asked me to take care of it for him, so I still have it. It's like 5 foot high and 5 foot across, and it has this magnificent shape to it. He just loved beautiful things, and he loved old things. And
because you also mentioned a story about Marc Chagall, and I think some neighbors had some Chagalls. I can't remember the exact aspect of it, but yeah, we had a Marc Chagall copy print in our house growing up. My parents were big into him as well. At the end, were Andy and Michael clashing about songs and song styles, or were they still in agreement on writing music?
There was, I believe, they when it came down to it, when they got in the studio, they were together. But I think they did have they had to have clashed some, because Michael wanted to move on. Grunge was happening, and it's not like he wanted to get into the grunge scene, but he felt they needed to update. He was really concerned about being left behind. That's very hard for a front man of that age.
Yeah, you mentioned, what was it?
On the Isle of Capri, that was not a happy situation.
Who was on the Isle of Capri?
The whole band.
Oh, really?
That was not a happy situation.
What album did they record on the Island of Capri? Was that Welcome to Wherever You Are, or was that... what did I wrote that down. I can't remember which. It was one of the later albums.
Yeah. So it would have been in 1991.
Okay.
Sorry.
That was the Welcome to Wherever You Are, Beautiful Girl time.
That must have, yeah. It was the on the album that they had Ray Charles.
Oh, yes, the Ray Charles recording, yes. Yeah. I remember the Ray Charles story. They were like, they gave him a couple songs and he chose one to record.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable that they had Ray Charles just out of the blue.
Yeah.
It just showed up and happened. But that's kind of the genius about some of these stories. I will say that towards the end, one of my favorite parts of the book was the Tim Stewart story, because it shared so much about who Michael really was and what he was like as a person. And it really gives you an insight on the band and sort of how they grew the way they did.
Mm.
Are we going to be seeing any of the solo stuff anytime soon as well? Any new solo stuff from Michael Hutchence?
Well,
is that all tied up legally still? You can't say anything?
I can't say much, but I don't even know everything that's going on, and I doubt very much that anything's coming out, honestly.
Too bad. I would love to hear some of his solo work.
I know.
It would be wonderful to hear. But you don't think it'll ever be released to the public?
No. I think the boys are all fighting over who's going to get the money. So, and I don't just mean in excess. I mean, there are attorneys and ridiculous.
When you were kids, did you travel to places like Vietnam and Thailand as well? Some of those countries when you were living in Hong Kong, any of those countries? Did you ever make it over to mainland China?
No, we weren't allowed in then. I mean, in the 60s, late 60s. Things were all going down in Vietnam. There was no way we could. Our dad used to go in. Kel used to go into China. He was with a special trade group. So they wanted him to go in and see, you know, see if they could do some business with him. And he'd come back with stories of, you know, he'd say he'd go into department stores and they'd just have one light bulb hanging down. You know, it was just very depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And but we couldn't do that then. In Vietnam, we were just getting, well, your guys were coming in for R&R for 5 days, four guys, five days. So I met a lot of Americans, and that's when I decided I want to live in the United States. I love the American man.
Because, yeah, you took off. You took off before your mom and Michael took off to the United States. And as a mother, having to leave Rhett behind tore your mom up. And you described that. Did those two ever reconcile?
They did, just not long before she passed. But that was just a terrible, terrible thing. But, you know, in those days, it's not like she decided, well, I'm just out of here. In those days, it took 3 years to get a divorce in Australia, and you had to be apart. And she could see there was no way that they could afford to have two houses and she could make enough money. I mean, it was just a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys were really troubled by all the infighting. And yes, she just showed up here. And Michael called me from L.A. airport.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did Michael and Rhett become closer as they got older over the years? I know you had said that they had a little bit of a brother argument as the last conversation, and I'm sure that's got to beat Rhett up.
Well, Rhett has been very truthful, forthright, and as you'll see in this movie, Mystify, he definitely had a drug problem, substance abuse, and Michael always tried to help him. And did many things to get him into different areas, to try to, you know, get him interested in working on something. And so they were pretty close, you know. They would have their brotherly fights.
Yeah.
But it is a shame. I mean, it's terrible. I must have been very hard on Rhett, you know, to have that fight. And then
the surreal insanity of that day still.
Yeah.
I can only imagine from your end. And trying to put the pieces together and being a detective. How long after he passed were you able to get a hold of his journals and start reading through them?
It was about 10 months. Yeah, our attorney arranged for us to go to his lockup in Hong Kong, where we were met by his accountant and a couple more attorneys. And there was just mother and I, and we sat on the cold floor in this lockup as they brought big boxes out, the things that belonged to Michael that had been left there over the years. And they would go through them first and then decide if we could see them or not. And some of the things that they weren't interested in were his journals. So those are the kind of things I wanted.
Yeah. You know? I'm glad that they weren't interested in those journals and things like that.
Yeah.
And do you still have all those journals to this day?
Yes.
I know you had said before we started recording the interview that the book was originally about 500 pages long. It's about 300 pages as a finished copy. What types of parts of the story did you cut out?
Well, when I had it finished, I knew it was too long, and the person I sent it to, who is just a brilliant man who usually advises Ellen and Unwin on what they should buy, he came back to me in about 2 days, and he said, I don't want anything that was in the last book. So that's basically, it's a new book. And you didn't miss anything. I got around to be able to tell the story, but didn't describe it in the same way as I did in the other book. It's completely new, as you can see.
Are you happy with what you wrote?
I really am. I feel that I've finally brought back Michael's legacy the way it should be. And then the next thing that's going to happen,
yes,
that because Richard's movie's out, and that's wonderful, but you know where we want to get a statue for Michael?
Really, where?
In Australia, in Melbourne.
Very nice.
And the councilmen are talking about it. They're very much with the whole thing. But I need people to go to change.org. Can I ask
absolutely,
people to do that?
Absolutely. And if you want to give out your website and if you want to give out your social media information, please do so people can access and get the book to read it. You have to read this book, especially if you're a fan of In Excess. It gives you a great insight on who Michael was. Just an amazing man.
Thank you, Marcus. We do have a website for Michael. It's Michael Kellen John Hutchins. info.com. And if you go to change.org, a statue for Michael Hutchins, and sign your name onto that, we're trying to get past 10,000 people.
You'll get it. All right. Do you have to be Australian to sign the petition?
No,
because
everywhere.
It's being done in Australia, so
yeah, no,
you don't have to have proof of citizenship or anything like that.
Absolutely not. In fact, we welcome from overseas. We don't have enough people in Australia.
Are there any final words you want to say about Michael or about In Excess before we wrap it up?
I would say that In Excess was a great band.
Yes, they were.
They put out the most amazing music, 10 albums. Wonderful stuff. And they were great when they were together. Andrew Farris and Michael just wrote some beautiful stuff. And I would say that I just want you to focus on the music and Michael's legacy. He was a very wonderful man. He cared for people. He really did. He had a great heart and made a lot of people happy. So I urge you to read my book, Michael, My Brother, Lost Boy of In Excess.
A fantastic read. Seriously, I enjoyed it. And it came out September 28th. And again, we'll post all the link and social media information up on the website. Tina, thank you very much for coming by and talking about the book. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Marcus. It was. I had fun.
So did I. Thank you.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.